Putin is not going to step down under any circumstances, nor can he step down. He's committed so many crimes, he's stolen so much money, he's ruined so many lives, he's killed so many people, that if he were to step down, he would be immediately arrested by whoever came after him. They would take away all of his money, they put him in jail, and he'd probably die.
For over a decade now, Bill Browder has been an international campaigner against corruption and human rights abuses in Vladimir Putin's Russia. A US-born British citizen, he made a fortune as an investor in Russia in the late 1990s and early noughties, and for a time, he had high regard for the Putin regime as one that would clean up corruption at the highest levels in business. That was prior to his expulsion from Russia in 2005, and 4 years later, the death of his lawyer Sergei Magnitsky in a Moscow jail turned Browder's firm Hermitage Capital Management into a campaigning organization promoting the Magnitsky Act around the world. That act allows governments to sanction human rights abusers and freeze their individual assets as well as deny them visas. Bill Browder is my guest in this episode of Insights. Bill, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
We've spoken before on RT Radio's Today show. First, when you published Red Notice, your account of corruption and murder in Russia. And then you wrote another book, a second book called Freezing Order, written just before Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. So much to talk about. Putin back now for another 6 years. Ukraine and the war and what might follow. Could or indeed will Putin attack an EU country? What happens if Donald Trump gets back to the White House? And of course, the death of the opposition campaigner Alexei Navalny. But I wanted to start, Bill, by asking you about another brave, perhaps a foolhardy political opponent of Vladimir Putin, and that's a man you know quite well, Vladimir Kara-Murza. Who is he? Tell me about him.
So Vladimir Kara-Murza is a close friend and ally of mine, and the way that I met him was that after my lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, was killed in Russia in 2009, I went on this campaign to get justice for him. And the campaign led to something called the Magnitsky Act, which you mentioned in your introduction, which is a piece of legislation to freeze assets and ban visas of human rights violators. And as I started to go around to different parliaments around the world to advocate for the Magnitsky Act, one of the big questions that I got from many people, many politicians, was, we understand the logic of freezing assets of human rights violators, but we have to be careful not to alienate the Russian people. We don't want to put together legislation that will harm the average Russian. And that's when Vladimir Kara-Murza showed up. Vladimir, he's about 15 years younger than me. He's at the time, he was very young, but he spoke Russian. He spoke English fluently because he was educated at Cambridge. He speaks French fluently. And he's an incredibly charismatic guy. And he would show up at these parliaments with me. And he was saying, I represent the Russian people. I'm an opposition politician. And what I can tell you is the Russian people don't like being murdered and have their money stolen by corrupt officials any more than you do in the West. And this is not anti-Russian legislation. This is pro-Russian legislation, pro-Russian people legislation. And he was so charismatic and persuasive that between me and him telling the story and talking about how it helped the Russian people, we got the Magnitsky Act passed in the United States in 2012. We got the Global Magnitsky Act passed in the United States, which didn't just apply to Russia, but to other countries. We got Canada, the UK, the European Union, Australia, Iceland, Norway, all sorts of places. In total, there are now 35 countries that have Magnitsky Acts. And he was the guy who made it happen.
And before we talk a little more about him, by way of parenthesis, you came to Ireland as well, Bill. You spoke to a lot of politicians. What was the outcome of that?
Well, this was an interesting story. So the way that I would go about this was to go to the parliaments of different countries, and I would explain to them, we have this legislation, the Magnitsky Act. It bans torturers and killers from coming to your country and freezes their assets. What do you think? And of course, what politician is going to say that's a bad piece of legislation? That's obviously good. Nobody would be against it. And so I showed up in Ireland, and I went to your parliament. I think you pronounce it your Doyle or something like that. And I made the pitch. And of course, everybody had the same natural reaction was, of course, we don't want Russian torturers and murderers coming to Ireland. And we put together a resolution. And the resolution was going to call on the government to put together an Irish Magnitsky Act. And then, just as we were approaching the final hour of this whole thing, the Russian ambassador to Ireland shows up, and he writes a letter to the head of the parliament, and the letter says that if you do this, we're going to ban the adoption of Russian orphans by Irish families. And apparently there was quite a few orphans being adopted or in the process of being adopted. And as a result of that, the resolution in the parliament was dropped. The intimidation worked. And of course, it didn't work permanently because at the end of the day, the EU passed the Magnitsky Act. Ireland is part of the EU and Ireland has to enforce the Magnitsky Act. But it was actually a very a sad moment for me and my campaign and a sad moment for Ireland to have been intimidated by the Russians.
It was something they had a response they had tried before, I think, in the case of the United States. And there were, I think, literally hundreds of children who remained unadopted as a result of that measure. But coming back to Vladimir Kara-Murza, who is now in jail, serving, I think, a very long sentence, something like 25 years. His background was as a correspondent. He was bureau chief for the Russian television station in Washington.
Yeah. So he started out as a journalist. And it was interesting because his career as a journalist for the Russian television station in Washington came to an abrupt end when he started publicly supporting the Magnitsky Act. They fired him. And that's when he became an activist and a politician. And he joined up with Boris Nemtsov. Boris Nemtsov is a famous and now dead Russian opposition politician. Boris was of my generation. And he was sort of Boris's protege. And he became very active in Russian opposition politics and standing up to Putin and calling Putin out for being a thief and a criminal. And they really hated Vladimir. Putin hated Vladimir. He hated him specifically because of the effective work he'd done on the Magnitsky Act. And in 2015, in the summer of 2015, he went back to Moscow. His wife stayed in Washington with their children after he got fired from his job as the journalist for Russian television. But he went back to Moscow in that summer. And one day I got this terrible call that he was in the hospital. And it turned out that he was in the hospital. He had collapsed. He had gone into multiple organ failure. He went into a coma. And it turned out he had been poisoned. And the doctors gave him a 5% chance of survival. And it was one of the most dark moments of my life, just praying and hoping and doing anything I could to try to help him. And miraculously, he lived through it. He came out the other side, not the same man he was before. He had all this terrible damage, nerve damage from this poison. He had a stroke at some point in the midst of this thing. He had to learn to walk and talk and eat again, but he survived. And then they tried to kill him again 2 years later with the same poison. And thankfully, the doctors that treated him the first time knew exactly what to do, and they saved him. And so they tried to kill him twice. And by the way, the people who were following him around were the same FSB, which is the successor organization of the KGB, the same FSB officers who had been following Alexei Navalny around before he was poisoned, Alexei Navalny being the other big opposition leader.
But Bill, I did use the word foolhardy, and I didn't mean it in a negative sense, but I mean, this was a man, Vladimir Kara-Murza, who, as you say, he campaigned with you. You advised him, you begged him not to go back there. This was shortly after the invasion, the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, and yet he insisted on going back.
I can remember it as if it was yesterday. He was in London. We were having dinner. The war had already started. And I said, where are you going to next? Because he didn't live in London. And he said, I'm going back to Moscow. And we were it was my wife and myself and him and his wife. And we were having dinner. And I said to him, you can't go back to Moscow. If you go back to Moscow, they'll kill you. They already tried twice and didn't succeed. They'll get away with it this time. And at best, if they don't kill you, they'll arrest you. And he said, no, but I have to go. He said, I'm a Russian politician. I can't let them tell me not to go. And more importantly, if I want to stand up against this war, and he was very much against the war and continues to be, how can I ask other people to be against this war if I am too afraid to go back to my own country? And I tried everything. I said all sorts of things that were probably, offensive to him, trying to convince him not to go, just because I knew that something terrible would happen. And as you say, it was, I don't want to say foolhardy, but that's not the right word. He sort of as effectively... He hasn't quite martyred himself. He had this romantic view that he wanted to be like the Soviet dissidents of the 1970s, and sure enough, he went back. He called Putin a killer and a war criminal on CNN, and 12 hours later he was in jail. And then they sentenced him, as you mentioned, 25 years in a high security, strict regime prison in Siberia, where he's sitting out his sentence right now, suffering, by the way, from all the after effects of the two attempts to kill him with poison.
And just about, I suppose, 4 weeks ago or thereabouts, I listened to an interview you gave where you were saying that, look, you know, the chances were that Alexei Navalny would not be killed, that there was no need for Putin to take him out, particularly coming up to the election, which you described as not being a real election, because he didn't really want to have a million people out protesting. But that's not how things transpired.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, when Alexei Navalny went back, and just to remind everybody of who Alexei Navalny is, he is the anti-corruption opposition politician who had captured the imagination of all the young people in Russia and ended up making these YouTube videos that are watched by, in some cases, hundreds of millions of people about Putin's ill-gotten gains and so on. And they tried to kill him once, like they did Vladimir with Novichok. He survived like Vladimir did. He went back to Russia like Vladimir did. And he ended up going to jail and being sentenced to 19 years in Siberia, just like Vladimir. And it's interesting because if you had asked me when he first went back, is he going to survive? I thought probably not, because Putin, you know, he can't tolerate this type of disrespect. But then like a year went by and he had survived, and another year went by and he survived. And by the third year, when you listen to that interview, I had kind of gotten used to the fact that for whatever reason, Putin was going to allow him to survive. And then Putin killed him. And then what Putin did, which was very effective, was he basically said to anybody, if you go out and you go out into the streets in any way to protest this murder, to honor Alexei Navalny, to grieve Alexei Navalny, you'll be arrested. And they arrested hundreds of people. On the just people were laying flowers in different places. They arrested people for laying flowers. They took photographs, facial recognition of people who went to his grave, and started harassing them and arresting them and so on. And it's turned into this most repressive police state you could ever imagine. I mean, it's not like it wasn't before, but it really is now.
And you must surely have a serious sense of foreboding then about the fate of Mr. Kara-Murza.
I don't think he's going to survive unless we can do something to get him out. We have to get him out. He's now the most important opposition politician in Russia. He's dying because of the poison that they had given him. He's in solitary confinement. He can't move around. He doesn't get medical attention to all of the ailments that he has. And the doctors who have looked at him in Moscow before he went to Siberia don't think that he's got 2 years, let alone 23 more years to survive. And so it's become the most urgent priority for my friend and my ally to get him out. And so that's what I'm spending a big part of my life doing, is working with governments all over the world to try to find the pressure points and try to find the way in which we can get them out.
How do you rate your chances?
Well, I've never done it before. This is the first time I've tried to free a political prisoner from Russia, but I'd never passed a law before I did the Magnitsky Act. And so, you know, sometimes necessity is the mother of invention, and I'm just turning over every stone and looking for every opportunity and meeting every government official and every politician who I can talk to find an angle, and we're getting there. I mean, we're not there, but we're,
mind you,
a million miles away.
It is hard to argue with the contention of the Economist newspaper in a recent issue, which had a cover story on Russia. A prudent working assumption has to be that Putin will be in power there for years.
I believe that entirely. I completely agree. Putin is not going to step down under any circumstances, nor can he step down. He's committed so many crimes, he's stolen so much money, he's ruined so many lives, he's killed so many people, that if he were to step down, he would be immediately arrested by whoever came after him. They would take away all of his money, they put him in jail, and he'd probably die. And this is not like wild speculation. That's just what happens in these places. And therefore, as a guy who doesn't want to die, he's got to stay in power, as tiring as that may be. I mean, he's now coming into his 70s, and you know, he could have a much nicer life not being president of Russia.
You, I think, have calculated that he and maybe 1,000 of his cronies or people associated with them have stolen something like $1 trillion. I think that's $1,000 billion from the Russian people, money that could have gone into hospitals, to schools, to universities, to infrastructure. How have they managed to get away with it?
Well, they've managed to get away with it in two different ways. One is that they completely control the Russian state. And so any crime that's committed in their own country doesn't get investigated. And then they've gotten away with it because they've completely corrupted the Western financial system. And so they've got so many people feeding at the trough from the West. And we're not talking about huge amounts of money, but people who are professionals, bankers, trustees, lawyers, PR firms that are all in London and in New York and in Geneva, who have all gotten rich off this stuff, that they've created and lubricated the international financial system to make sure that that happens. And what I can tell you is that very, very rarely does any law enforcement agency do anything about it. And I learned about this firsthand because after my lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, was murdered, he was murdered over the theft of $230 million. And I spent 10 years tracing the $230 million. And then I would, when we find it went to a country, we would then file a criminal complaint. And we found 26 countries where the money went to and filed 26 criminal complaints. 16 of those countries opened criminal investigations. But I can tell you two that didn't: Britain, the United Kingdom, and Ireland. Ireland didn't.
What did you trace here?
We traced a few million dollars to, or euros, I guess, to various different firms in Ireland. And they didn't want to know. I guess they called them your Guardia or whatever.
Guardia Síochána.
They didn't want to know. And so that was another disappointment with Ireland.
Can you recall what year you came here with those complaints of criminal activity?
Yeah, it was probably, 6 or 7 years ago.
Let's talk about the war in Ukraine now. Listen back to our very first interview in 2015, and that was after you published Red Notice. And at the very end of that conversation, you spoke about the need for the United States and for NATO to provide military support to Ukraine following the annexation of Crimea and then the way Putin had gone about fomenting insurrection in eastern Ukraine. Now, since the full-scale invasion just over 2 years ago, the European Union and NATO have provided a lot of resources since then. But looking at how things have been unfolding, is it really, or has it been, a story of too little, too late?
Yeah, absolutely. Too little, too late. And I'll tell you what the problem is, that I've seen it firsthand. In the summer after the full-scale invasion, I was at a conference called the Aspen Security Forum in Aspen, Colorado. And they gathered up a lot of really important people, including Jake Sullivan. Jake Sullivan is President Biden's national security advisor. And Jake Sullivan pretty much said it outright at that conference that we want to give the Ukrainians enough weapons so they don't lose, but we're afraid of giving them too many weapons because what would happen if they win? You know, what would Putin do? He was so afraid of escalation, of inflaming Putin, that he basically came up with this, as you described it, a too little, too late military support strategy. And that's where we are right now. So the Ukrainians have been amazing in terms of what they've been able to do with the weapons that we've given them. But the Russians outgun them 10 to 1.
Yes, and even though the Ukrainians got off to a great start in the sense that the resistance was much stronger, Putin, his own war machine, was less effective than he thought it was, and what was expected to be a fairly quick campaign would gradually develop into, I suppose, a kind of trench warfare, and not a whole lot of progress for one side or the other. But in recent times, it seems that the Ukrainians are struggling more and more. They're losing some territory. And as well as that, the sanctions that were imposed on Russia, they don't appear to have had the effect on the Russian economy that was expected. It's proven to be far more resilient, maybe, than people had expected it to be.
Well, so the sanctions have been very punishing. It's no joke that we've frozen $300 or $350 billion of Russian central bank reserves. It's no joke that we've banned Russians from the international financial system through SWIFT and to borrow money. The oligarchs are none too happy to have their assets frozen around the world. But there's one gigantic loophole in this whole thing, which is that we've said to Russia, you know, in spite of all this, you can still sell all of your oil and gas, for that matter, wherever you want. And because of that, Putin is making, you know, between $500 million and $1 billion a day from the sale of oil. And that money is going to buy weapons from the North Koreans and the Iranian drones, and spending money on what's now a full-time war economy. And so we can't really expect all, unless we do the sanctions completely, again, it's too little, too late kind of thing. So we do it halfway, and then we don't want to do the oil. And as a result, we end up in this situation where they're selling their oil for dollars. They're using the dollars to buy weapons. They're using the weapons to kill Ukrainians. And then we've got to give dollars to the Ukrainians to fight back. Ukrainians are losing territory. They're losing men. And the reason they are is that Putin doesn't care about how many soldiers die. He just doesn't care. I mean, it's remarkable. The man completely lacks any human empathy. And so according to Ukrainian estimates, they've lost something like 440,000 soldiers dead. And that doesn't take into account all the ones who were injured. And Putin just keeps on throwing more men into the meat grinder. And the more men he throws into the meat grinder, the Ukrainians have no choice but to fire back. And if they're running out of bullets to fire back, then these people they haven't made a huge amount of progress, but they made a little bit of progress at a huge dead man cost to the Russians. But the problem is that they're running out of bullets, and bullets cost money. And they don't. It's not like they have a natural resource base in which to generate cash. And so if we want the Ukrainians to fend off the Russians so we don't have to fend them off ourselves, we need to give them money.
The other great uncertainty is the November election for the presidency. I mean, how do you think a return, and it's by no means far-fetched, nothing like the, being far-fetched, the return of Donald Trump to the White House, how might that affect things?
Catastrophically, as far as Ukraine is concerned. Donald Trump has said he wants to cut off funding for Ukraine. And so we're in this situation where he for reasons that we don't know. I mean, to this day, we don't know why he feels this way. It certainly isn't in the U.S. national interest or anybody else's interest to have the Ukrainians lose. But for some reason, he wants that. If you look at the betting shops, Donald Trump has got a better chance of being president than Biden being reelected. And so that's the base case scenario right now.
And he did say at a rally some weeks ago that, if he gets back, well, as far as he's concerned, Putin can do whatever the hell he wants. Now, he's since rolled back a bit from that in an interview with Nigel Farage, saying, look, that was a kind of a negotiation stance he took to try to persuade the NATO countries in Europe to commit to their obligations to defense spending. So maybe he's not as reckless as he would initially have appeared to be.
I mean, that's a kind of terrible position to be sitting in as a citizen of the world, saying, it could be catastrophic, but maybe not. Let's just play this out for a second. Let's just say that he cuts off funding for Ukraine. That means that the EU and the UK and other allies have to double their funding for Ukraine. Are they going to be able to do that? I don't know. I don't think so. I think that there's just not enough money out there. And so what happens next? The Russians get Ukraine. And then what happens after that? Well, if you listen to the rhetoric coming out of the Kremlin, they're saying, well, Ukraine is interesting, but we have much bigger plans. We don't like these Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia to be free. And so all of a sudden, Putin's attacking those places. And then we have this terrible choice. Do we go to war with Russia, which is something that everybody has been trying to avoid since the beginning of this thing, because they're NATO allies and we have a treaty obligation to protect them? Or do we abandon them and say, well, actually, you know what, that NATO thing, that wasn't really a treaty anyways. And then all of a sudden, Putin then has free rein to go all over Eastern Europe.
Just on that point, there was a piece written by Stephen Collins, a long time and well-regarded columnist in the Irish Times. I suspect what he wrote recently will not surprise you, but he talked about how a senior NATO figure in Dublin, visiting Dublin, stunned EU ambassadors at a briefing when he told them that it was not a question of if Russia would invade the EU, but simply a matter of when. Now, this is Admiral Rob Barr from the Netherlands, chair of the NATO Military Committee and the chief military advisor to the organization's secretary general. And people who were there said, look, if this had come from one of the Baltic states or some figure, we would have said, yeah, that's what they say. But coming from this senior figure, Dutchman, it really made them sit up in their chairs.
Well, you don't have to be some kind of fortune teller. You just have to listen to what they're saying in the Kremlin. They're saying it. It's not a mystery. It just goes on and on and on, where you can just read the transcripts coming out of the Kremlin. And you know what they're going to do because they're not hiding it. And that's why this guy is saying it. And anybody who's close to the situation, who's paying attention, understands that that's the issue, that that's the risk. And it's going to create all sorts of unbelievable problems. I mean, the French president, Emmanuel Macron, has already started to openly muse about the idea that that French soldiers may be on the ground in Ukraine, because they can't, if Ukraine falls, we can't have it, you know, move further west.
He didn't get much support for that suggestion, and has he not pulled back from it since?
No, not at all. In fact, very interestingly, almost nobody has noticed this, but Marine Le Pen, who is his main competitor, has now switched positions against Russia for Ukraine. She was always like pro-Putin before. And so I don't know what's going on domestically in France with their politics, but it seems to be that they're a little bit ahead of the curve now on this whole, what do we do about Putin? And maybe he doesn't mean any of it. Maybe this is what we could call strategic ambiguity, which is very helpful, because Putin, you know, all this stuff saying, you know, that there's a red line, we won't go in and help the Ukrainians, we're not going to do that. That means that's just like a free invitation for Putin to do whatever he wants. By leaving it uncertain, you know, then all of a sudden Putin doesn't have that feeling. And I don't think he wants to be at war with the NATO or France or whomever, because, you know, that's a little different than being at war with Ukraine.
Coming back to Donald Trump for a minute, Bill. Yes, he said these things that are reckless and that can be quite frightening. Also coming up with a line saying, look, if I get back, the Ukraine war will be over in a day. But hasn't he got a track record of making some pretty shrewd observations? I mean, he did ask very loudly, what in heaven's name are the Germans doing organizing this gas pipeline from Russia through their own territory? I mean, it gave Putin an incredibly strong piece of leverage over them, which he has no doubt set out to use.
Well, I mean, you know, Donald Trump has done quite a few things that I would approve of. For example, the Magnitsky Act was more rigorously enforced during his administration than any administration, and things like that. But I mean, whether you like him or don't like him, it doesn't take away from the absolute terror of if he allows Putin to win in Ukraine, then we have just the worst possible, you know, future for ourselves and our children here in Europe.
You yourself had quite a scary time when Putin and Trump met in Helsinki at a summit. Your name actually featured in their exchanges.
Yeah, this was pretty strange. So this is back in 2018. The two presidents were meeting for the first time in an organized summit. They had sort of come across each other on the sidelines of other meetings, but this was like the summit between Russia and the United States. And it was on a Monday. And on the previous Friday, Robert Mueller was the U.S. special counsel who had been assigned to investigate Russian interference in the U.S. election. And he had indicted 12 Russian military intelligence officers on that previous Friday. And on on Monday was the summit. The two presidents had a meeting. And interestingly, it was a secret meeting. No one was allowed in other than the two presidents and one of Putin's guys. There was no national security advisors or entourages or anything, which is very unusual. They then emerged from the secret meeting. They went out to the press conference. And one of the first questions that was asked by a journalist was to Putin, saying, Mr. President, are you going to hand over the 12 military intelligence officers to the United States now that they've been indicted? And Putin had obviously been expecting this question. He smiled. And he said, well, you know, it's entirely possible that we would. But if we did so, we would expect some goodwill and reciprocity from our American friends. And specifically, we would expect them to hand over Bill Browder, me.
That caused your telephone to light up.
It did. Well, it was very unpleasant. But it wasn't totally unexpected, because Putin has been chasing me around the world for a number of years after the Magnitsky Act was passed. He was been trying to extradite me, and Interpol read notices. I was arrested several times on Interpol, all sorts of nastiness. And he had been regularly speaking my name in public, and so that wasn't a surprise. But what was a surprise was the next question went to President Trump from another journalist. And this other journalist goes to President Trump and says, well, what do you think about Putin's offer? And Trump, without skipping a beat, says, I think it's an incredible offer.
So what happened after that? You're still a free man.
So I was actually in America when this was happening, and I was panicking It was very interesting. I thought that he would back down and back off, and that his staff would say actually he misspoke or whatever afterwards. But this went on for this sort of thing was hanging in the air for 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, and then on the fourth day, the Senate, the U.S. Senate, decided to have a vote on whether to hand me over, and they voted 98-0 not to. And at that point, Trump walked it all back. But it was pretty horrifying, and it's scary now. So what happens? What do I do if Trump gets elected? Do I go to America? He doesn't have Robert Mueller investigating him for Russian collusion. He doesn't have to run for a second term. Putin still wants me. It's a pretty scary thing.
And I suppose part of that scary side to your life or to your existence is that he's got other ways of tracking down his enemies and people he wants to get rid of.
Yeah, well, we all know about radioactive polonium in London. We all know about Novichok in Salisbury. We all know about all the assassinations and mysterious deaths that he inflicts on people in the West. And I'm on that list. There's no question. I used to be at the top of that list back in 2018. I'm not on the top of the list anymore because Zelensky's on the top of the list, and Navalny was higher up before he was killed. But it's not a very nice it's not very nice to be me in a world that where Vladimir Putin exists.
You frequently say, though, that your emphasis on looking ahead, looking to the future, not looking over your shoulder. But at the same time, I would have thought that you have to take some pretty serious precautions.
No doubt about it. I mean, it's my life is one big series of precautions. But and a lot of people say, well, how do you live with that? And the answer is the same way that somebody who's got diabetes has to go and get insulin. One gets used to your circumstances, whatever they may be. And this has been going on for a while, and thank God I've survived. I've been very careful. There's this expression that I've got to be lucky every day. They only have to be lucky once. But so far, I've been lucky every day.
That was the quote of an IRA spokesperson after the Brighton bomb in 1984 when they almost took out Mrs. Thatcher. That's where that comes from. You probably knew that anyway.
I actually didn't, but thank you for that.
So it's not just the Russians now who have been expressing an interest in you. Your name featured in proceedings in Hong Kong of late.
Well, I mean, this is the dumbest thing I've ever seen in my life. So, when I was going around the world trying to get Magnitsky Acts passed, one of the countries that I was really interested in is getting Japan. Japan is an important economy of the world. I wanted them to have a Magnitsky Act, but I didn't know anybody in Japan in the parliament there. And so I started asking around to friends of friends, and I had a friend here in London who knew somebody who knew somebody who was a Japanese parliamentarian. And so my friend in London organized a conference call with a guy who was sitting in Hong Kong to see whether he would be willing to introduce me to this friend of his in Japan. So I have a conference call with him. His name is Andy Lee, and we have a nice call, and he seems impressed by my mission and wants to help. And so the next call we have is with this parliamentarian in Japan, and she then puts a Magnitsky Act into play in Japan. And little did we know that while we were having this conference call, his call was being listened to by the security services of Hong Kong. This is shortly after they passed their first national security law. And so they were listening to the call, and I guess didn't like what they were hearing. And so the security services then issued an arrest warrant for Andy Lee. And Andy got wind that there was something not right, and he tried to flee Hong Kong on a boat along with 11 others. And the Chinese authorities learned about their attempt to flee and intercepted the boat, arrested him, took him to Shenzhen in China in a nasty prison, and tortured him for a month to such an extent that he then became a witness against a bigger fish, a guy named Jimmy Lai. Jimmy Lai is the owner of the main newspaper in Hong Kong called Apple Daily. And Jimmy Lai is a big enemy of the Chinese Communist Party. And so they got Andy Lee to become the star witness against Jimmy Lai. And in the charge sheet against Jimmy Lai, they said that Jimmy Lai is responsible for violating the national security law, which is a life sentence. And how is he violating the national security law? According to the prosecutors, He was colluding with foreign co-conspirators. And who are those foreign co-conspirators? Me, the Japanese parliamentarian, and the guy who organized the conference call. And I've never met Jimmy Lai in my life. I've never spoken to him. I've never communicated with him by email. I've never had any contact. They've just come up with this complete fabrication out of whole cloth that that's why Jimmy Lai should go to jail for the rest of his life. And that's why I'm a co-conspirator. And so now I don't have to worry about Russian Interpol arrest warrants. I've got to worry about Chinese Interpol arrest warrants.
And you're smiling slightly when you say that, but I mean, do you take them seriously, the Chinese?
Of course, but I can only travel to about 10 countries anyways since this Russian nastiness started. And so I can't, it's not like those are the countries where there's a rule of law where I'm not going to be extradited on some, you know, politically motivated nonsense coming out of China. So I can smile only because my world is already contracted 98% really.
Do you put all or virtually all of your time now and efforts into this campaign on the Magnitsky Act and also trying to highlight the case of Vladimir Karamurza? Or, I mean, are you still an investor? Do you still practice that side of things?
Well, I'm no longer managing other people's money. So that's what I used to do for a living. I gave that up. And so I'm pretty much a full-time activist at this point. And the one thing you didn't mention that I'm doing is I'm trying to get the $300 billion of central bank reserves of Russia that had been frozen after the start of the war. I'm trying to get that money confiscated and handed over to Ukraine, because I think that could be the thing that
I actually read a piece about that in the New York Times a few weeks ago, Bill. There was a suggestion made that Joe Biden, when he was asked, I think it was over 2 years ago, what would he do if anything happened to Alexei Navalny? And he said, oh, Russia would face devastating consequences. And it was the confiscation of precisely that money you referred to was suggested as one way or one means of bringing devastating consequences to Russia.
Yeah, it's really it's shocking. I mean, well, part of the problem is that Russia has faced devastating consequences for going into Ukraine. And so we've kind of like hit them with all of our devastating consequences. Then they kill Navalny. And what else can we do? And my argument is we could confiscate $300 billion. We should call it the Navalny Act. And we should say to Putin, that murder just cost you $300 billion. Thank you very much, Vladimir.
How strongly would you rate the prospects of that happening? I mean, it seems like a dramatic measure that could be taken. Would the support be there for it in Congress?
Well, I think the support is there for it everywhere. Why should the taxpayers of Ireland or the UK or America be on a lower footing than Putin? Why should Putin's money be protected before our money is protected? His money should go first, and then we send our money to Ukraine. And by the way, this solves the whole. This is Trump insurance. If Donald Trump were to cut off Ukraine and we confiscated the $300 billion, most of which, by the way, is in Europe. Then Ukraine's got a long runway to actually finish off this war.
How do you think things will unfold? Obviously, nobody can say for sure. But generally, conflicts, no matter how long they drag on for, they either end with some sort of a settlement, a holding situation, or a victory for one side or the other.
Well, I think the best comparable here is the Iran-Iraq war. It went on for 8 years. There's a million deaths on both sides. And eventually, it just petered out, because it's just too painful for both sides. This war, Putin can't stand down, because if he does, he can't compromise. If he does, then he loses his job and dies. And if the Ukrainians allow the Russians to succeed, then they all get tortured and die as well. And so this is going to go on until it just runs out of steam, and I don't see that happening anytime soon. And we should prepare ourselves emotionally and financially for that eventuality.
Could you see him being taken out by some people in his own circle who basically either get fed up or see a bigger chance for themselves as a result of what he's doing?
I think not. I think that the chances of him getting taken out by his own circle are pretty close to zero. We saw what happened with the Yevgeny Prigozhin last summer when, he had a moment of
he was the mercenary boss of Wagner Group.
The Wagner Group, yeah, the one who was marching towards Moscow. And I don't think there's a person in Russia that doesn't have the image of that plane sort of cartwheeling, careening towards the ground to,
Well, he did make himself a bit of a target for Putin. I mean, he flagged his intentions. If you were, presumably there must be people who would be maybe more subtle and secretive in going about something like that.
I think Putin is looking out for treason, even where it doesn't exist. And I don't think it's going to, I think there's nobody's going to step in there. The only way that the Putin regime comes to an end, in my mind, is if the Ukrainians were to win the war and expel Russia. Putin would then look like such a weakling and such a bad judgment character that I think the Russian people would rise up. And Putin can't control the public uprising. That's the one thing he can't control. He tries to, of course, by threatening everybody and arresting all the leaders. But when lots of people go to the streets, that's something that he doesn't really have much control over. And that's the way that if there's any chance the regime ends, that's how it's going to end.
Are you going to keep on this campaign now pretty much into the foreseeable future for as long as there's a breath in your lungs?
Well, that seems to be what's happened. I mean, I've been on this campaign for 15 years. And when I first started, people thought I was a nut and crazy and was exaggerating and some had kind of my own personal psychological issues about Russia. And it turns out that everything I said was true. Now there's a lot more people who are with me on this campaign. I'm not by myself, but I think it's something that's absolutely necessary, not just for me and those close to me, but for the whole world.
Prior, though, to the imposition of heavy sanctions as a result of the Russian full-scale invasion on Ukraine, how effective had the Magnitsky Act been in the various jurisdictions?
Well, I think the best way of measuring its effectiveness is to look at Putin's response to the Magnitsky Act. When the Magnitsky Act was first passed in America, as we mentioned earlier in our conversation, he banned the adoption of Russian orphans by American families. That was just a sort of like a first step. And then he made it his single largest foreign policy priority to try to repeal the Magnitsky Act in America and prevent its spread to other countries. And he put that in writing. And then, of course, he went around the world trying to kill me, kidnap me, arrest me, and all that kind of stuff, leading up to that crazy moment at the Trump Helsinki summit. I think that what we can say is that Putin understands what makes him tick. He values money more than human life. And if you put his money at risk, that's just an existential risk for him.
Prior to the 2016 United States election, there was all this speculation about what did Putin have on Trump, and there were various dossiers circulating. It was very hard to discern where was the truth, where was the fake news, as it were. What's your own assessment of that now?
Well, first of all, I don't think that Putin had any blackmail on Trump. I mean, he probably did, but I don't think that Trump is blackmailable. I mean, look, Trump, is sleeping with porn stars while his wife is organizing insurrections. He's doing all this crazy stuff, and that doesn't seem to get him fired. So he's unblackmailable in my analysis. And the second thing is that he doesn't seem to honor any financial obligation that he ever made. And so why would he honor a financial obligation from the Russians if he didn't honor anyone else's financial obligation? He's a serial defaulter and bankrupter. I don't see that as being an influence. I think that the reality is that Trump just likes rich guys. He likes Mohammed bin Salman. He likes Vladimir Putin. And he just likes guys who have a lot of money. And he hopes that some of that money is going to come his way, either now or in the future. And that's why he's so nice to Putin.
Finally, what do you like to live with? I mean, all of these restrictions on you are one thing, but what about your family, your wife and children?
Well, they can't travel to a lot of countries either, and we have to be very careful. But, everyone gets used to their circumstances, whatever they may be. I mean, we don't live in Kiev right now. And every day, everyone has to go down to their bomb shelters. I think we've got a safer, calmer life, even with this thing hanging over our heads, than many, many people in the world. And I certainly can't complain about my lot in life when I see, the terror that so many people are experiencing in so many different places.
Bill Browder, former tycoon, I suppose we could call you, a human rights campaigner, author of two remarkable books, A Red Notice and Freezing Order. Thank you very much indeed for your insights.
Thank you.
To hear more in this series, go to rte.ie/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.